The school bell goes off and all of the kids are lining up outside. I'm in sixth grade and it's a warm April day in 2006. Kyiv is full of life. As all of the kids and the staff are standing outside of the school building, we honor the 20th anniversary of the Chernobyl disaster with a minute of silence. We then listen to a series of usual speeches by our teachers, and as a kid, I'm incredibly distracted and obviously bored. Thinking about it now, it's bizarre how little connection I felt to the Chernobyl disaster when I was growing up. I mean, the biggest nuclear catastrophe in the world happened less than 100 kilometers from where my parents lived. My parents, teenagers at the time, absorbed the radiation into their bodies and then 9 years later passed it on to my body. And yet, when I was growing up, Chernobyl felt like a distant event from the past, something as distant as any other event from the history books.
The Chernobyl disaster occurred on April 26, 1986, when a reactor at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in Ukraine exploded during a safety test. The explosion released a massive amount of radioactive material into the atmosphere, making it one of the worst nuclear disasters in history. But the Soviet authorities kept it a secret for days, whilst radiation was seeping through Ukraine, Belarus, and beyond. The immediate aftermath led to the evacuation of nearby residents, a rise in radiation-related illnesses, and long-term environmental consequences that continue to affect the region today. But what does it mean for contemporary Ukraine? How have we processed this collective trauma as a society? How does it affect how we react to Russia's environmental crimes in 2023? And why did we decide to start our podcast from here? This is a special season of Ukrainian Spaces, a podcast elevating diverse Ukrainian voices and explaining Ukraine to the world. When we were planning this episode, I asked Marishka, Stas, and Maxim to write down some of their memories about Chernobyl to help us navigate this journey of discovery. I couldn't help but feel a similar sentiment after hearing Stas recount his memories. For many of us born after, Chernobyl was something we knew about, but never really fully understood. We didn't understand its significance both for modern Ukraine and for millions of our fellow citizens whose lives had been directly affected. Later on in our lives, we'd see films, TV shows, and read books about it. But for the majority of our lives, our knowledge was limited and based on discussions we had with our loved ones. Unlike the rest of us, Maxim had actually lived through it.
So I'm 6 years old. I'm standing next to our village house in southern Ukraine. In front of me are fresh veggies we just harvested from our own garden, some cabbage, zucchini, and cucumber. But I have this tense, concerned look on my face. So I take my little personal radiation dosimeter out, a bright yellow gadget. Looks like a pocket calculator, really, but instead it produces this unmistakable clicking sound when turned on. I check each basket of veggies with it. Everything is within the norm, but only this time. This is not an isolated case of some weird kid's game. Our house has many radiation dosimeters and my parents encourage me to use them, especially if I go to play in the field or in the hedges. We're living not far from a nuclear plant and it has never had an incident, but so the authorities say. My parents trusted the state once and it almost killed them and left their only kid with chronic thyroid disease. So after Chernobyl blew up, nobody told them, and for weeks they would take their newborn on strolls under the radiation fallout. All of it while Moscow was silently installing security checks around Ukraine to prevent radiation-contaminated Ukrainians from trying to seek refuge in the parts of neighboring Russia that remained clean of the radiation. That's when they learned that Ukrainian lives were dispensable for Russian rulers.
Even though I didn't live through Chernobyl myself like Maxim did, it would always haunt my family's conversations. Those conversations would raise a lot of questions in my head that I'm still answering today. How could Moscow intentionally keep this disaster secret knowing that it would affect Ukraine, Belarus, and many others until today. My dad remembers going to a big demonstration on Khreshchatyk Street for International Workers' Day on the 1st of May, 1986. It was a big deal for the Soviet Union, and the authorities would force thousands of people to march down Kyiv's central street each year. This year was no exception. He remembers all the workers from his factory and other factories parading, walking. He was walking with a friend of his, and the friend had two small kids. Suddenly, both children started bleeding from their noses. Back then, he worked at a factory that produced rubber and latex in Kyiv. Later, they were involved in trying to come up with a cover for the reactor to stop the radiation from seeping out. But even they were not aware of what was going on until 5 to 6 days after the disaster happened. That's when the panic in Kyiv set in. The cars of officials rushed to Boryspil Airport. Those with privilege tried to escape and run away. But it was much harder for ordinary people. I remember a family conversation about how hard it was to get my cousin, who was born the same year as Maxim and as the Chernobyl disaster, out of Kyiv and to her son. What lengths they had to go to simply get a tiny baby into safety. I always felt that the secrecy that surrounded the Chernobyl disaster was indicative of the Soviet Union's quest to save face over saving human lives. A calculation always made not in the favor of ordinary people. It felt to me that the decision of the leadership in Moscow to keep it quiet showed their willingness to disregard the safety of those they were meant to serve. My dad told me that it was one of the first moments that people in Ukraine started really questioning the authorities. 5 years later, the Soviet Union would fall and Ukraine would become independent again. But was I the only one who felt that and thought that way? Here's Marichka reading out her own memories.
My family didn't speak a lot about the Chernobyl disaster, but I remember asking my granddad about it. He used to work in local authorities at that time, so I was sure he knew about the explosion the moment it happened. I was sure they left Kyiv the same day, but he didn't know. Life in Kyiv was very casual and normal. He told me that later he heard some advice like drink red wine and close the windows, wash your hands and hair. He told me that the streets were washed with water every day in Kyiv. But nobody in my family had realized the scale of the tragedy for the next 20-25 years. And it sounds crazy. It is only now that there are multiple films, TV shows, books, and podcasts about Chernobyl. Before the full-scale invasion, foreigners would flock to Ukraine to go on tours of the disaster zone. But before Chernobyl became popular, we found out about what happened through our personal histories, through the verbal retelling of those days by our parents.
Until recently, I didn't know the answers to many of the questions that I had about Chernobyl. But seeing Russia's blatant disregard for human lives and the environment today makes it easier for me to answer them. I was desperate to know if my friends shared this sentiment with me.
Guys, this is going to be the first episode that we delve into the history of Ukraine and our memories. Well, for this one, it's hard to say our memories because most of us weren't born back then. And some of us were too small to remember anything. But nevertheless, it's a really important part of our story, of Ukraine's story, of our people's story, and the story of our identity. So I wanted to actually ask you all, because I was thinking about this as I was listening to some of the thoughts and the memories that you shared. And I was wondering, why did we choose to start our story from Chernobyl? And why was it important for us to do that in this particular podcast, but also in general? Why does it make sense to start from this as the beginning?
To be honest, for me, I never thought about the history of modern Ukraine through this prism of Chernobyl disaster. And I think I'm just now starting to realize all this like snowball effect that it had on where we ended up in the end. I think this topic specifically, I'm more of a listener than a speaker in a way, because I am like in the process of kind of reflecting upon this and understanding this for myself, all the significance.
Yeah, you know, I was trying to prepare for our conversation and just reading a little bit about Chernobyl written by Ukrainian scholars and foreign scholars. And just like you, I was thinking about the fact that only now do I realize this kind of significance of questioning authority that Chernobyl brought with it that led to eventually, I guess, Ukraine's renewed independence in 1991. And it strangely didn't click before. It was like one of the many kind of domino pieces that eventually led to where we are today.
Yeah, for me, it's also very weird because I think that I realized, like, for the whole of my life, I realized that Ukraine survived through really huge, like, enormous tragedy as the Chernobyl disaster. But somehow I kept collecting all the pieces of information about it also through the whole of my life. And for me, it's like so weird, and I cannot understand how such kind of events that could change the lives of millions of people, and not only in Ukraine, but like in different other countries, neighboring countries, and the whole Europe, for example, how we still cannot understand. I think that we cannot process all this tragedy, you know, fully, because even now I'm a grown up. I already read a lot of information about it. I spoke to my parents a lot about it. Those people who actually witnessed the whole event, I still keep getting some new pieces of information, and I cannot understand why we cannot accept that this happened and it changed us so much.
Yeah, almost like not accepting that it was such a big part that influences us today. And there was this one quote I found on the National Library of Ukraine on their website. And I think that it also kind of really summarizes what you said, which is that Chernobyl does not have a past tense, that Chernobyl consequences are felt today by Ukrainians, by some Ukrainians more than others, obviously. But in general, they're still felt in our health, in our land, in a lot of things. But they are also felt politically. Yet, for some reason, we never connect the consequences, the political consequences, with everything else. We haven't been connecting them for such a long time.
I think when we also talk about it in our introduction to the show, about the process of reprocessing our past as integral part to our decolonization journey, I think this is absolutely crucial story to understand a modern Ukrainian. Because even if we, you know, some of us are born later, the clock for modern Ukrainian independence starts exactly there. Many of our much older intellectual leaders like Oksana Zabushko or others from the region, for example, Svetlana Alexeyevich from Belarus, a Nobel laureate, they all talk that this was the tipping point. Like, for many empires, disregard to environment and to human life is kind of an integral part of how they operate. But it was the tipping point for many Ukrainians who still, in totalitarian imperial environment, believed the empire. This is when their belief crumbled and they understood that not Ukrainian environment, which is super important for every Ukrainian, our nature, our connection, our intimate connection to our nature, is not important for the empire, nor human life, especially Ukrainian life, is not important for the empire. And I think this is where our story about modern day independence starts, but also about Ukrainian identity, modern Ukrainian identity, the root is also there.
And I guess it's also the frustration with like the fact that we couldn't make our own decisions for our own land, for our own country at that crucial point in time. You know, there were people in Moscow sitting and waiting and calculating about, you know, how to say, what to say, who to say it to make sure that they save face, because obviously it was already 1986. And it was important for the Soviet Union, which was in like already a process of stagnation and not great economic situation and political situation. It was important for them to like keep their face in front of the international community. And I think for us, that was the first time, I guess, that it was like your decisions are directly, not the first time, but one of the most directly impactful decisions that the Soviet regime was making on our land and bodies and everything. You know, the Soviet regime was acting in kind of their self-interest, from my understanding, but having direct consequences on the way that we were going to live, not just for like 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, but for many years. And if you look at the map of like the consequences of Chernobyl, you can actually see that the two countries most affected were Ukraine and Belarus. And at some point in Soviet Union, there was this perception that the Soviet Union was equally impacted by this massive disaster. And so, you know, all decisions were for the benefit of all people. But actually, there were countries that were affected more than others. It was happened on the territory of Ukraine. And it also showed the consequences of like this fear-based regime of the Soviet Union that everyone was scared to tell everyone else and the authorities. And the authorities were also scared. The people were scared. And it ended up kind of putting our lives and our land and just so many things in a very precarious position that we feel, you know, consequences of up until today.
I think, Valeria, when you mentioned fear just now, I think it's important to understand how much fear people lived before that in Ukraine, being scared, as we intimately know from our own families, being scared even to talk to your closest ones about some topics, and some topics were complete taboo, not mentioning, you know, anything that could endanger your security because you know that you cannot trust anyone. And I think this was a triumph of the empire, ensuring that you feel absolutely on your own and scared and not trusting anyone. And this was also the turning point because people started talking back and people started being angry and not afraid to talk back. And one of the first memories I remember after that is this powerful environmental movement in Ukraine during the Soviet times and then independent one during the first years, because I lived in a horrifically polluted region of Ukraine, in the Zaporizhia region, where people were not scared to talk back and were not scared to raise these issues anymore. And I think this also is the value of Chernobyl, kind of breaking that spell of paralyzing fear that people had before.
Yeah. Serhipo, he writes about this as well, that actually Ukraine's movement for independence had a big ecological component within it. The rise of civil society that was caused by Chernobyl, and civil society, yes, to do with matters of our land and our environment, but it still gave a push to groups that organized to protect our environment. And so I think later when Ukraine did become independent, that continued into our modern days of Ukrainian, renewed independence. But about fear as well, I know we spoke about it a lot in our memories that we recounted, but Marichka, I know that you also shared with us a post that your dad published on Facebook some time ago, and I just wanted to ask you if you could possibly read it to us.
Sure, of course. Actually, my dad wrote a lot on Facebook and on some forum website before even Facebook. So he somehow managed to preserve a lot of his memories, like even since his childhood. And he sent me this post. He wrote it actually on the 30th commemoration day of the Chernobyl disaster. And the post goes like this. On this day, 30 years ago, I was coming home from school. It was warm, springtime, and classes were over. Beautiful. And then this guy, a bit older, suddenly informs me that his dad was called to work in the middle of the night because the nuclear power plant in Chernobyl had exploded. I only heard the part about exploded and immediately asked, "Did Voice of America tell you that?" "No, man, I'm telling you. They called my dad to work in the middle of the night. His dad worked in the regional committee of the party, Chernihiv." I only believed the news a day or two later when there was no other choice but to believe. And you talk about how they believe in junta, bolfinges, and so on there. The Soviet Union and the KGB know their business.
So I think I just thought it was so interesting how he compared conspiracy theories with like how people can believe in stuff, you know?
Yeah, because like my father, he always, you know, like he actually taught me a lot about this, like how weird and kind of comic Soviet system was in some ways. Like, I mean, they told a lot of bullshit and people believed it, or like, you know, just
went along with the bullshit.
Yeah, just went along, you know, just because of the fear, of course, and everything. And he... My father and I think that like all of our parents, they actually really like they understood how all this propaganda machine actually worked in those times. Of course, there were people who actually believed in this stuff. But I mean, people who, like, with critical thinking and maybe with some, I don't know, additional resources of education and money and everything, they actually realized how bad it was. And this is why they understand the connection with, you know, Soviet Union and modern Russia society and modern Russian propaganda. It's like, it's really obvious for them. And now it's obvious for us.
Isn't it also kind of crazy how propaganda kept working even when, like, the lives of, I don't know, thousands and millions of people were at risk? Like, it was still propaganda above all of that. And to me, that's just insane.
No, I think one of the weird, like, our parents are about the same age, and my dad, my mom also have these, like, very specific memories about this whole disillusionment. But I think they were, like, young people back then. They already had a lot of doubt in the Soviet system, in Soviet propaganda. But a lot of them just kind of went along with all these lies. And the social contract was that, well, you know that we're lying, but let's just pretend that all of this is real. Let's pretend that this country that we're depicting in our news, it's actually a real country, and just, like, ignore the reality. And I think Chernobyl in some way was this, like, tipping point for a lot of these people who just accepted, while they knew it was all a lie, but they kind of accepted Soviet Union for what it was. And that was probably the moment that a lot of them realized that if we keep accepting this, the system will keep killing us consciously or just, like, collaterally.
But Valeria, why do you think it's surprising or something unusual? Because, I mean, Russia has and is still, it has always been a death cult. And this absolutely even religious disregard to human life was integral to Soviet Union as well. I think just practically that generation didn't face anything like that. It was not generation that faced the World War II and then the amendment famine after World War II. So it was maybe 20, 30 years of relatively peaceful life. And this was the first major catastrophe where people understood, like, yeah, this empire does not give any F's about anyone's life whatsoever except their own in Moscow.
Yeah, you know, I think the reason I probably said that I felt surprised was because an environmental catastrophe of this proportion, like, it might sound weird, but to me it seems like it's something that is beyond any kind of political games or any kind of attempt to control power. You know, controlling power can only hold you in so much control when there's a massive environmental disaster of the scale. But you're totally right. You sometimes just seem to forget the fact that this empire has shown complete disregard for human lives before. And for some reason, you think of the Soviet Union in the 1980s and you're like, oh, Gorbachev was in power and it was beginning to come to an end. And obviously, we know that Gorbachev did also a lot of horrible things in his time as leader of this horrible empire. But at the same time, it was when he was in power that the Soviet Union finally collapsed. You know, the Soviet Union opened up under his leadership. Actually, to reframe this, it didn't open up under his leadership, but his leadership led to the questioning of authority by the people in the countries that were part of the Soviet Union, like Ukraine. And so I don't know why I'm surprised, but that's why I think it's super important for us to have these conversations. And that's why we're starting this episode here, because this collective trauma that Ukrainians have because of Chernobyl has consequences for us today, as we said before. And it has consequences for both how we react to what's happening in Ukraine right now, but also it has consequences to how we analyze what Russia is doing in Ukraine today. And as you said, you know, Maxim, it's the repetition of some of these things that this empire has done to us again and again and again that makes us aware that it's highly possible that it can happen again. So I actually wanted to ask all of you, what consequences do you think this collective trauma of Chernobyl has on Ukrainians and our identity today in the context of the full-scale invasion and Russia's actions in our country today?
I actually want to share with the rest of our listeners that when we decided to have this topic and have it as a first one, there wasn't that much of enthusiasm on your guys' part because you weren't entirely sure that this is, you know, is either going to be interesting or is that integral to what has shaped us, specifically because many
you know, majority of us were born after that. I think I'm the only one who was born on this that year. However, I really wanted to start or have this episode within the season for a simple reason, because for me, it's, of course, it's horrific environmental, just horrific catastrophe. And so many people died and so many people were crippled, including my health, because of it. But for me, it's a cool story of this activation of Ukrainian superpowers. And I want to bring it a bit closer. We're going to talk about it later in the season, about 2014 and the Revolution of Dignity. But do you guys remember that it was massive snowstorm in Kyiv just before the revolution, winter before the revolution, that the entire city was collapsed, paralyzed? And also, do you remember that the entire government collapsed? Like, nobody helped anyone. Like, no municipal services, no government, nothing. People were stuck in their cars, in the highways, just like trying to survive on their own. Like, the entire government just did zero. And for me, and also we talked about it back then a lot, I think that was the moment for many, at least inside Kyiv, to realize, okay, we need to do something about it. This is not working out. This government, these people, they do not care about us. They do not care about our lives. Something needs to change. And when I think about Chernobyl, of course, I don't remember that myself. I haven't seen that. But from the stories that my parents told me, from other people who documented it, that was exactly on such a massive scale, the wake-up call for many Ukrainians to activate this Ukrainian resistance. Like, okay, this is not working out in any way. We just need to do something with it. And this is where Chernobyl becomes a very Ukrainian story, because other people who suffered from Chernobyl, for example, in Belarus, that wasn't the same conclusion that people came to. It is as horrible trauma, both mentally and physically in terms of health, but it didn't lead to the same kind of people rising up and the activation of a national and resistance spirit.
You know, we actually were the only country to launch criminal investigations into Politburo members and their responsibility for what happened in Chernobyl. We actually weren't successful. Like, our attempt failed, but it was like one of an example of how we actually used our, as you say, resistance spirit to make actual tangible change happen. And even if it wasn't successful, it was still a real life action that we did to at least bring Ukraine closer to justice in some way or shape or form. And Ukraine also actually had some of the most liberal laws as well about who was considered as someone affected by Chernobyl, as a victim of the accident. And so it just shows that, like, even in the face of something so horrible and something so tragic, Ukrainians were able to respond in a way that was both full of compassion, but also still had that spirit of pushing towards justice and resisting injustice in the face of the struggles that we had. So I thought that was super important for us to mention. But Stas, do you also think that it has consequences for the way that today we see the events unfold in Ukraine, whether that is the whole country holding our breath as we saw Russian troops again enter Chernobyl, or everything that was happening around Zaporizhia or you know, the Kherson Dam, or anything else?
Yeah, actually, I think the thing that Maxim told, like this parallel with the events of Maidan of 2013 and that winter, I think maybe Chernobyl is some kind of blueprint for Ukrainian society's relationship with its own government, like all this social political pact that we have post 1991. I think it works in this sort of pattern of very careful trust, very like sort of skeptical trust, that is based on this idea that as long as the government doesn't cross the line, then we're just kind of like keep doing our stuff. And Chernobyl probably was maybe one of these like huge catalysts that made people see that, you know, this is the line. And I think Maidan was another event that also was the line, like Yanukovych's decision to just beat peaceful protesters and just use force against completely peaceful people, again, was this moment when government crosses the line and activates Ukrainian society in these like super unexpected ways.
I think also when we talk about in the context of Ukraine's spirit of resistance and just in general, you know, people fighting back against the unthinkable today and always, we can't forget about the first responders. And Maxim, I know you've done a lot of work to bring their stories up and disseminate more to people.
I think when I actually it happened with a Chernobyl TV show on Netflix, right? Because for me, those names weren't that well known. And I think for you guys to agree that we didn't hear much names in our schools or universities when we studied that period, even in, you know, in Ukrainian. So it was a shock for me, for example, to find out that there are just three people, Oleksiy Ananenko, Valery Bespalov, and Boris Baranov, three Chernobyl first responders who decided to sacrifice their lives and prevent second explosion at the station that would actually make most of Eastern Europe and maybe Central Europe a nuclear desert, killing millions, that's for sure. And nobody knows those names. And when the TV show went out, I went on Twitter kind of posting the stories of who they are, their names, and people were so shocked. It went viral and people were writing to me saying, why don't we know these names? We've never heard about it. But for me, it's also a story of about modern Ukraine as well. Similarly to today, Ukrainians, and then back then also Belarusians as first responders predominantly were shielding the rest of the Europe from the consequences of this disregard, Russian disregard to human life and horrific incompetence. And they sacrificed a lot, including their lives, so the rest of the Europe can, you know, be as it is today because of that. So these names should be definitely remembered, and people should definitely educate themselves more about the first responders.
So guys, the time has come for our closing remarks, and I'm really grateful to all of you for this conversation because it has helped me process a lot of things myself. But I was wondering if anyone wanted to add anything and leave our listeners with anything specific that they've been thinking about.
I have only a small comment because you told that I totally agree that Chernobyl is something still ongoing. And I think that part of it is because this collective trauma still hasn't been processed fully by Ukrainians. You know what I'm talking, because when I spoke to my parents about everything, what happened, even like few years ago, they still told me that they kind of didn't sure that it was a huge tragic, because like luckily it didn't touch my family that much. So for my mom, for example, is what like she told me, of course, those times she didn't realize everything what happened. So for her, it basically was kind of day offs from her uni, so she went to Crimea, you know, to spend some time there near the sea. And like then, when I asked her when exactly did she realize the whole horror of this disaster, she told me that she wasn't sure about it. So I think that part of collective trauma is something that really difficult to accept and really difficult to go through, especially together. You know what I'm talking about? Because it's easier to look away and, you know, just to be like, okay, we should let it go. It happened. Of course, it's still, we can feel it because people who survived through it still alive and everything. But I think it's like just my opinion and the way of actually societies survive through collective traumas is that we really need more time. And I think it's also a part of why this specific topic is so important of speaking about the independence of Ukraine.
Yeah. And I think also honesty in these conversations is super important. Just honest conversations about what this means for us and what it meant for us, I think, are so important for us to move forward. And I was just thinking, you know, like I remember for a long time, because I grew up abroad, and I remember the only two things people would know about Ukraine when I would say I'm from Ukraine was either Shevchenko, the football player, or Chernobyl. And Chernobyl people knew because of like popular culture, right? Like movies, TV shows. I don't know. I think it was in like so many different popular culture references to Chernobyl. And it was in the West, it was usually, I don't know, like some place for some evil supervillain to host his laboratory. And I'm obviously, you know, exaggerating, but it was always represented in this way, like mutants and all these weird things happening around there. And that's why people knew about Chernobyl, right? Only recently we've been seeing more kind of honest depictions of what was happening in Chernobyl done in the West, but also there's of course been like a lot of these works of literature, art, and so on and so forth in Ukrainian society, but the world has always seen it and sort of almost in a really messed up way romanticized it. And I think that has also prevented us from processing this and from processing what Maxim was talking about, which is that, you know, what happened in Chernobyl was actually a consequence of a continuation of this pure disregard for human life of the empire that at all costs was trying to like protect itself from falling apart, even when like millions of people's lives were in danger.
But I'm glad, guys, that you mentioned that this is an ongoing story. And that's why it's so important for our listeners, especially who are foreigners, to educate themselves on Chernobyl more to understand Ukraine of today. And in recent years, there's been more quality, let's just say, focus on Ukraine abroad. There was this very well-done TV series on Netflix about Chernobyl, but also recognition of the works of Svetlana Alexeyevich, a Belarusian Ukrainian author by Nobel Prize, who got Nobel Prize for her works on Chernobyl, is also part of the trend. But I also wanted to, for example, recommend people to check out this insanely cool documentary that one of our previous guests on Ukrainian Spaces, Oleksiy Radinsky, did and just released called Chernobyl 2.0. And for me, it's a very cool story and a reminder that A, Chernobyl was, despite what the Russian propaganda in Moscow claims to the date, was a man-made disaster in a way that it was a result of horrific incompetence of people who designed a station in a way that they didn't care about the environment or people, and they definitely had zero regard towards anything human. And when they didn't pay for it, what they'd done to Ukraine, to the rest of Europe with the worst nuclear plant explosion in history. When they invaded Ukraine and they went through Chernobyl, they threatened to do the same, absolutely the same, right? They forced their soldiers to dig inside these horribly radioactive forests, disregarding to their lives, most of those soldiers probably dead by now. They blackmailed the rest of the Europe, taking control of Chernobyl. They're blackmailing the rest of the world now, holding hostage Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant that can blow up at any point still. So they didn't pay for that back then. So they're doing it again. And I think that this is a lesson we should take out of it. Apart from understanding Ukrainians better, how we were shaped by this catastrophe, we also can understand the empire better. Unless the empire starts paying for these horrific acts, more Chernobyls will be in the future, maybe even more horrific than this one.
The stories we've shared today are not just memories or historical accounts. They're our reflections on our nation's collective trauma and resilience. Chernobyl, a tragic chapter in Ukraine's history, is a stark reminder of the price ordinary Ukrainians have had to pay for the actions of those in power in Moscow. As we've delved into our personal recollections, we've seen how deeply this event has shaped the worldview and relationship with power of many Ukrainians. The secrecy, the sacrifices, and the aftermath of Chernobyl are emblematic of the larger struggles Ukraine has faced, from Soviet suppression to the contemporary realities of a full-scale invasion. Yet, amidst this darkness, there is hope, resilience, and a determination to remember, learn, and rebuild. This episode will leave you with Maxim's story.
The first time I saw the painting called The Atomic Spring, I had zero idea it was about Chernobyl. I just felt this chilling fear spreading through my entire body. A grotesque monster-like creature grazing at a luscious Ukrainian field. An instant question in my head. Has this monster invaded that beautiful field? Or what he eats poisoned it and made a monster out of this creature? For many outsiders, the logic of this question would seem bizarre. But for me, as a Ukrainian, that puzzle made all the sense. Chernobyl forever poisoned our Ukrainian nature. Murderous radiation can lurk from behind the most gorgeously looking nature. The painting was created by Ukrainian renowned artist Maria Primachenko in 1989, a part of the so-called Chernobyl series. Back then, before the restoration of Ukraine's independence in 1991, talking about the most horrific man-made catastrophe our continent has ever seen was a Moscow-enforced taboo. Primachenko, like many other Ukrainian artists, had to channel our trauma in non-verbal ways. Not only did this Russia-made disaster rob us of our health and the basic trust in the surrounding nature, but they wouldn't even allow us to grieve openly.